Hey Cal, guess what? I started Chained Echoes the other day.
Well, it's about time since we're recording right now.
True. So I was a bit confused by some stuff, so I was asking one of my friends to try to explain all that mech stuff the other day and the whole overdrive system.
Were they able to?
Maybe, but I really couldn't gear what they were saying.
So, Matt, you restarted, but were you able to finish the game?
No, I just got stuck spending too much time grinding and grinding, and I finally just got angry and quit.
Grinding? I didn't find I needed to do much in this game.
Lucky you. It just left me feeling chained to this game.
Ew.
Lucky you. It just left me feeling chained to this game.
Ew again.
Lucky you. It just left me feeling chained to this game.
Okay, Matt, enough with the echoes.
Kel, I love the mech battle so much, didn't you?
Yeah, they made me so happy. They were great.
I loved all the mech designs, except the pretty but sad sky-colored one.
But I love that one. It was such a beautiful design.
So, what was everyone's favorite character in the game?
Victor.
Victor? What an odd choice. Why him?
He just seemed like such a real winner to me.
So no one said all games were gonna be this way. Backlog's a joke, a choke. Gaming cards at my hay. It's like you always play 2 years behind. When you really need a boost to heart, to health, or even your mind. No, Cal'll be there for you.
She'll say games that are so.
Matt'll be there for you.
When you're feeling that you're stuck.
We'll be there for you.
Cause we've all been there too.
Hello and welcome to RPG Backtrack, your regular deep dive into your favorite RPGs. We are a production of RPGamer.com, bringing you such fine podcasts like RPG Cast, your weekly RPG news show, Q&A Quest, your weekly RPG feedback show, and us, your bi-weekly RPG nostalgia show. I am your host, Kelly Ryan, and with me, as always, my podcast partner in crime, the Kyle to my Glenn, Mr. Matt Mason.
If I had played enough of this, I would know what that means, but I'll just echo your sentiments that you are my podcast partner in crime.
Awesome.
And we're chained together.
Chained like two chain gang people.
Yeah. Chained like two people on a chain gang.
Also with us tonight, not necessarily chained to us, but one of our veterans nonetheless, Pascal Takaya.
Hey, I got a joke. You screamed into the void for anybody to join you on this podcast, and I was the only one who heard the echo.
Fair. Boom. Fair. You know, sometimes we only get one person that signs up. But it just means that we'll have a cozier show. Because we are talking about Chained Echoes tonight. And technically all three of us played it, but I think only two of us finished it.
Mm-hmm.
And only one of us liked it?
I liked it. I thought it was a pretty good game, all things considered.
Well, then we have nothing to disagree on. This will be the most the most one-track
no
show
drama.
Ever. 100% of us enjoyed the game.
Tam hated it. He called it Systems the Game, and I don't see where he's coming from.
I get it.
I mean, I got far enough into it, but I didn't feel overwhelmed by that. I finally found the root cause of why I stopped playing, but yeah, we'll get into that later. But
I think that complaint is common.
Oh,
I think
okay.
People, not to say that the majority of people feel that way, but I think the people who had a problem with the game, that was it. It was, well, Systems the Game. That wasn't an issue for me. I just, you know, I get the complaint is what I'm trying to say.
It wasn't an issue for me, but I think it was because I ignored a lot of the systems that people say were annoying. Though I do still have a little bit of a problem with one particular system, but we can get into that when we get done with the intro. Bring you some beautiful music from this game and then come back and we'll just dive right in. And welcome back to RPG Backtrack, where we are talking about Chained Echoes, released on December 8th, 2022, made by German developer Matthias Linde, who I learned that that was the sole developer of the game. Kind of interesting.
Really?
Yeah, I did not know until I started researching today that it was technically made by the one guy, though it did have music development by someone named Eddie Maria, oh god, I'm gonna butcher this.
Eddie Murray?
No, Maria Nucano, who composed over 30 tracks. But the game itself started development in 2016 and then finally had a Kickstarter campaign in 2019 and then finally released in 2022. The developer, Matthias Linde, grew up making games in RPG Maker, and his favorite games included Xenogears, Terranigma, Secret of Mana, Suikoden 2, and Breath of Fire, The Legend of Dragoon, and Final Fantasy VI. Yeah, which... It.
This is why I quit, because Legend of Dragoon related.
I mean, yeah, the Overdrive... Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead and make your point, because...
The Overdrive stuff and the Sky Armor stuff definitely echoes Legend of Dragoon.
Explain how you mean that.
Because in Legend of Dragoon, you get those armors that enhance your powers. And the I'm not sure about the Overdrive stuff, though.
Yeah, the Overdrive, I was really trying to remember hard about Legend of Dragoon and what resembled the Overdrive system, and I wasn't coming up with anything. Dragoon is the time
that's
button
the timing base,
super
yeah.
Different.
Yeah, I guess that's what I was thinking.
I was actually thinking, out of all the games you mentioned, Dragoon is maybe the least like Chained Echoes.
But Xenogears makes sense because of the mechs. Suikoden 2 makes sense because of the town building. The rest of them are just kind of influences.
Yeah, not to mention the graphical style and the, you know, the sprite work, the 16-bit look of it is very reminiscent of a lot of those games too.
Yeah. I tend not to like a lot of modern pixel art games because they, I don't know, there's something about it that's like, it looks too bad to be part of the era, but too, well, no, I never know how to explain it. It's like something about modern pixel art when it's trying to ape old games, just something is off about it to me, but this little game nails the style. This could have been a PlayStation game. It's a little bit too beautiful to be a Super Nintendo game, but definitely could have been a PlayStation game.
Well, I don't know. Is PlayStation known for beautiful pixel art?
Isn't that the Suikoden games?
Suikoden, yeah.
But, right, but compared to that, I think, God, I'm going to say Chained Memories at some point. I know I will. Chained Echoes, what I think is way prettier.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Oh, I mean, yeah, all the modern pixel art, I think, in our head.
Point.
Yeah, I was going to say in our head, it's what we were seeing back then. But when you look at them side by side, yeah. I mean, it may be aping a 16-bit style, but they're using the full color palette and, you know, a lot more pixels.
Well, I kind of thought that was Kelly's point that, like, a lot of modern pixel art games look too pretty to be a PlayStation game, and like this one definitely does too, but I guess I misunderstood what you meant there.
Yeah, no, it seemed like PlayStation, and bear in mind, back when the PlayStation was popular, people did not like pixel art games. They wanted the new 3D hotness, so games like Suikoden 2 and or the Suikoden series, and like, say, Castlevania Symphony of the Night, I want to say weren't as popular, but they didn't get popular again until Symphony of the Night, when people realized, well, we don't need to do 3D. We can just make really pretty looking 2D art and have it be amazing. But the companies at the time didn't want to fund stuff like that because they wanted more 3D stuff. And we only got Symphony of the Night because they also agreed, or I think Igarashi also agreed to do the Nintendo 64 games.
Yeah, well, I mean, Chained Echoes came out 2 years ago, and at the time, the whole HD 3D thing was still was less of a known quantity. I mean, Octopath Traveler had come out, and was that maybe the only HD 3D we had at the time?
Yeah, that was.
Yeah, so that, you know, that
what, 2 years ago? Oh no, by two years ago, we even had we talked about it earlier this year. The was the remake of the Japanese only Square Enix game,
Live Alive.
Live Alive. Yep, that came out. We've had. I mean, we've seen Dragon Quest III 4 years ago. They showed it off that they were doing it. So, I mean, it's been around. Oh, and what's the tactical one that came out from
Triangle Strategy?
Triangle Strategy. So, I mean,
well, yeah, I'm not saying that it's brand new, but less of a household name than it's become in the 2 years since, even, I would say. The whole
You're HD right, because 3D. Yeah, we've had. We're getting HD 2D.
Is that? Oh, I'm misnaming.
He keeps saying HD 3D.
Right, right.
That's the modern games. That's your PS5 awesomeness. But HD 2D. I get it.
Yeah. So to me, like Chained Echoes. Well, so Kelly, when you say things like the developer grew up in RPG Maker, and so when I hear RPG Maker and indie 16-bit game, you know, I think the worst. Like, I, to me, I'm, oh, what's the what fan RPG maker game am I about to play? But I think that Chained Echoes is like one of the best examples for how to like marry that old school style to like modern sensibilities. Mm-hmm. And like, you can see the RPG Maker influence, but it's so elevated, and not just with the graphics, but with the gameplay too, which, you know, I'm sure we'll spend a lot of time talking about the combat system. I think it's one of the best examples for how to do it well and right.
Yeah.
So I loved it.
Because it says on the Wikipedia article, he was mindful not to copy his favorite games, but wanted to capture his experience of playing them, which makes sense. I definitely feel like, yeah, I can see where he got his inspirations from.
Yeah, you can choose. You don't have to wholesale take it.
It also seemed like he cut a lot of the fat out of what makes RPGs boring for some people, but both for good in some cases and both for bad in others, because this game does not have any experience points. You level up in fixed intervals based off of either completing a major boss fight or completing certain objectives in the what was it called? The objective grid? I can't remember what that was called now. It was basically a big old grid of things that were like achievements, but most of them were tied to the achievements that you could do
like
in the game.
Challenge board or something like that?
Yeah, the challenge board.
Yeah. Almost like a trophy list in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. So
it did have points though. You did earn I forget if it's TP or SP.
Yeah,
you earn
like that,
skill
yeah.
points, right? Skill points you did earn, I think, through regular battle, and you do use them to improve individual skills across characters.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not quite a level up, but you do earn something for normal combat.
And then you also get money, obviously, and materials to upgrade your weapons, so you could make yourself stronger that way. And materials were pretty easy to get, either by completing quests or just upgrading weapons or finding them in treasure chests. And at first, when I was playing the game, I have to admit, I kind of was annoyed, because it's like, well, if you're not going to have any experience, then what's the point of combat?
Mm-hmm.
Matt, I know that you definitely felt that way.
Yeah, and I'll say, I guess now's a good time to mention it as all. So I played this for like 8 hours 2 years ago, and then something happened and it just got set aside. And when we talked about doing this, it was on my Backtrack homework. And then Atelier Ryza just like kicked the door down and said, I know what you're doing for the next 3 months. So oops. But I went back to this and I put in like 3 to 4 hours in this past weekend, and was going back and forth with this and Sea of Stars, which I know we'll get to relatively soon. But I started customizing. I went in, and I don't know if that level of granular customization was in the menu before, because I feel like I turned off completely turned off that, what was it, the heat up?
Yeah,
whatever.
I turned that off. I turned that off too, or made it so that it was very negligible.
Yeah, so now when I was playing the other day, like, I could just make it wider. And making it wider made all the difference. I was running around getting into battles just for the heck of it, because I was like, oh, I see this now. And I don't think I paid enough attention to different attack types and, like, the, I guess, the family of attack, how far that could knock it down the overdrive part, like, get me back in. And I was actually having a lot of fun with that. Thank God it was bigger, because sometimes I was just like, I need to get out of this combat. But there was a lot of times I was like, oh, I would probably never in a normal playthrough use this one skill. Like, I never need this. I've got better ones. And I was using skills that I normally wouldn't, because it changes every few rounds of battle which skills drop the overdrive down. And I was like, this is more fun than I remember.
I do think that those options were there before. You might have not noticed
them. I don't think that. Yeah, I was going to say, they don't seem new. They were right there in the options menu. And yeah, I've just turned it off. But turning it down, not having it off, but like turning it, or giving myself a little bit more grace with the size of that, that was fun. That was fun. I've enjoyed the 4 hours, and I was like, oh man, too bad we're recording this week, or I'd have played some more, because I'm enjoying the combat now.
And I honestly think the overdrive meter is there just for people that want to challenge themselves, that aren't bulldozing through combat, because for regular battles, I was just using as many AoEs as I could to get the monsters down as soon as I could. And it was the boss fights where I felt really challenged to be like, okay, I need to, you know, throttle my damage in such a way so that I'm taking advantage of weak spots and those kind of things. It was the boss fights that I felt really challenged compared to, you know, some of the other stuff.
Yeah, that was like one of my main points in the review a couple of years ago, is that visually, and when you just read like a synopsis of the developer's influences, you might write this off as saying, oh, this is, you know, somebody who loved Super Nintendo Final Fantasy, and this is his take on it, and, you know, and so on. I mean, I think the one thing that's going to stick with anybody who plays this the most is the combat system. And I mean, I'm just going to go ahead and say it. I think that in Chained Echoes, the combat system is better than it is in any of the games we mentioned as a an influence, because it's not, I mean, it's a turn-based combat system, but it's so much more. It's not just revive, but it's iterated on so heavily that I've never seen anything like it. And I hesitate to I don't want to say I love it, because there's definitely negative aspects of it. Like, it has a lot of stress that it brings with it. Which, you know, maybe I'll find ways to talk more about that later, but it's really novel and it's very engrossing. And I mean, it's just, I don't know, it's incredibly smart, like what the developer did here.
And I get why they took out, or why he didn't want to do leveling so that you wouldn't necessarily grind your way through problems. I will admit, I kind of miss level ups, because there's something about that dopamine hit of, you know, having the numbers go up and getting more skill points and going to go to the menu to assign them.
But I think Matt's kind of right on when he says, like, the battles just became fun for their own sake. And that's, you know, true, because of the combat system and the, like, the tightrope walk you have to perform in every single encounter. I would have a hard time thinking that I would want to replay it. Like I said, I don't know if I'd want to expose myself through a whole nother playthrough of having to deal with that level of, like, such a juggling act that it requires. But man, it was just so, I don't know.
Well, go like me in the option system and give yourself a third hand to juggle with. That's where I did, like, before I turned off the juggling, basically. And you're right. To me, then it just becomes a turn-based battle system, whatever. But no, like I said, widening that thing and really, really paying attention. Like, I was like, you know what? I feel like I almost missed that last time. I was just picking, like what Kelly said, I was just picking the big AoEs and whatever. And I wasn't, like, using the spell that, like, increases the other guy's damage output. I was like, why would I do that? Like, I can just attack myself, blah, 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 whatever. But seeing that, like, hey, if I do that, I can get that. I'm about to go out of my overdrive meter area, but I can get that back down to the midpoint. Why not? What the heck? What's one? It's just one turn. You know, one person's one turn. Let me get this back to the middle, and then the next three or four people can do big attacks and bump it back up. But yeah. Oh yeah, and I found, you guys were talking about the reward board, is what they call it, and that I remember being, I was captivated by that. That I would get in the combats and go looking for that extra whatever. You know, there were some that had treasure chests, and I give me a checklist and I'll do it. Mm-hmm. And that reward board was a fun winding checklist of stuff.
I thought that was a real nice way to encourage you to explore each area as much as you can for treasure chests and some of what were they called? Like the named monsters or
basically.
Yeah. The hunts, some of those hunts I had a hard time. I had to look up what to do to get them to spawn because some of them were pretty obscure.
Fun fact. I had nowhere to look to find how to make them spawn when I was playing it.
Oh, wow.
Guides had not been written yet.
Oh, trust me. I just got done with Dragon Quest III, playing that before. And the whole, you know, the big thing they added in the new Dragon Quest III remake this time is having all these recruitable monsters. Like they added a new job class and they threw 108 or something like monsters in there. And I knew somebody else was reviewing the game and texting him back and forth. Like, how many you got? We got like, well, I got 45. Did you find the one here? You know, it was like being in the 1980s or the 1990s again. Cause I mean,
108, is that a Suikoden, influence?
It actually might be more than that. It might be like 123. It was kind of insane because the other reviewer and I, we finished like one day apart and we're writing our review and messaging back and forth. Did you find this? Do you remember this? Blah, blah, blah. Just trying to jog our memories. And we both were something like, oh, we did really well. You know, we caught like 50, 55 monsters, whatever. And then, you know, the day the embargo lifts, RPG site puts out their strategy guide for it. And it's like, what the hell? There's over 115, something like that. 113, 118. I don't know. Whatever it was, it was like, wow. And I'm not going to go back and replay it to go through that. But yeah, us reviewers, we get you got to do what you got to do. And a lot of times you miss out on those things because there's no resources.
And I have to admit, I was kind of bored with the game, but I pushed through. Because, you know, I wanted to see where it was going because I thought that the story is intriguing. And then once I got to Act 2, where you get access to your sky armors, I was hooked. Mm-hmm. So the game has kind of a mecha system. Only in this game, they're called sky armors. And once you get access to those, not only are you more powerful so that you can curb stomp some of those trivial battles, but you can fly so you can kind of explore around the map a lot more. Now, like, as you go further and further into the game, they do things to restrict your ability to fly in certain maps, like, say, having areas be too small for your sky armors, or having like giant
missile defense grid set up that can't fly.
Yeah. Kind of arbitrary restricting you, but it does make sense so that you're not just bulldozing all of these maps. And then, you know, once you're done with the conflict in the area, then you can go back and explore to your heart's content. And that's where I got hooked because I loved exploring all of the different areas and seeing where I could go, what I could land on, trying to figure out, okay, how do I get to this kind of far off nook? Because there isn't a place to land, but clearly I'm meant to, you know, make it over to this area. And then also kind of maddening because some areas you don't even get access to until the very, very end of the game. But, you know, you see those icons on your reward board kind of taunting you. And then I think by Act 3 is when you get your base, and then that's when they add the recruiting mechanic, where you're basically doing Suikoden, where you're recruiting members for your base.
I never got that far, no.
Yeah, you have to fill your base with people from the game world.
Some of it
mechanic.
Yeah, some of it is as easy as just talking to a person. Some of it involves side quests. There's a lady that you recruit almost right away that tells you where everybody is, and you can sit there and keep having her tell you, and then she's like, well, I can't find anybody right now. So you know that you could recruit those people pretty much right away. So, you know, after you finish a major story point, you can go back to her and kind of see, okay, now are more people available? Okay, I can go find these people. And just like with Suikoden, as you find more and more people, your base grows and grows, and the buildings start to take place, and you know, the cave that they're in kind of becomes more furnished and less like a cave. And that is just incredibly satisfying.
I guess, are we already in the part of the game that's systems? Because would this count as a system, the quote-unquote base building?
I would it say
seems like
so.
Like a game system, sure.
Yeah, I think this is one of the areas that I neglect a little bit. That doesn't, you know, that doesn't draw me a lot, having to populate a base. I couldn't tell you how much of that I did. I don't even remember if any of that is mandatory. Probably some of it is, I would guess.
Yeah, some of it is.
But I probably, you know, moved on as soon as I could, from as soon as the game let me. I found the story to be compelling, you know, compelling enough on its own without like the late game stuff. I think even my exploration was kind of minimum. I know I went back through and used the sky armors to, you know, like you were saying, find some of the hidden items, etc. Maybe even a couple of optional bosses. But I'm sure I left a good chunk of it, you know, just still out there. It's a long game, even by just following the critical path.
It's like 40 hours, like on the
40 to 50. I think, you know, I did.
I'm sure. But like the baseline, like if you're running through it, I think is like 40. So yeah, you start adding. You know, base building and everything else that you could do and whatever. Yeah.
My Steam library says my total playtime was 46.5 hours, and it felt a lot longer than that. Because I didn't try to 100% the achievements, but I tried to do as much stuff as I humanly can because I didn't want to put the game down. I completed the reward board.
Oh, wow.
I was very proud of that.
Went to town on it.
Yeah.
But the funny thing is that I completed, well, like the minimum number of points that you can get on the reward board is like 120 to get all of the rewards. And there's still rewards after that. Or there's still stuff that you can do after just getting to the minimum.
Oh, geez.
So, yeah, that was kind of interesting.
You're locked out of certain things?
No. It's possible to get all of the rewards and not have to do all of the nodes on the reward board, so that you can kind of pick and choose what you want to do and don't want to do.
Are you the kind that found all 900 Korok seeds in Breath of the Wild?
I didn't do that because that was pretty tedious.
But I mean, talk about that dopamine hit. You want to get that dopamine hit 900 times.
Yeah. I did, however, what did I do? But like in Pokemon games, I do a living Pokedex just because I'm crazy like that. That's where you get one copy of every Pokemon.
Meaning that you actually did collect them all.
Yeah.
But not even that. You have one of each. Like, you don't just have your Charizard at the end. You've got, you know, a Charmeleon left and a Charmander and a Charizard. You got all of them in there.
Yeah, it involves a lot of planning and a lot of trading and sometimes even having to both copies of the game or a friend or a husband that's willing to help you.
But not a wife. Just a friend or a husband.
Well, yeah, I mean...
Well, if my wife's not going to be playing, so... They were good.
If you have a wife that's into Pokemon, then you hit the jackpot.
That's why I have children.
Or children.
Yep. But, and, hey, that's the only reason I did it on the last one. My kid's now old enough to, like, hey, I'll do all of them with you. Let's go.
And to be honest, I don't even know what compelled me to do the completion, because most of what you get for completing it is just the joy of completing it in this game. You get some cool armor and weapons out of it and classes.
There's two more checklists that, Matt, you probably saw, but you might not have played long enough to engage with either one of them. Surely you noticed that during enemy encounters, there's tool tips on the bottom of the screen that include things like steel and canned.
Is that oh, yeah.
You know what? I didn't get to the canning, but actually right now I'm on the website thegamer.com and reading about the complete guide to the cannibal enemies. I'm like, oh my god, I didn't do this. I didn't
get the Blue Mage.
So there's a late game Blue Mage that you get, and then you can start a whole new checklist of do I really want to hunt down every creature and can them. And by the way, the animation of him canning his food is hilarious.
Yeah, because he cans them and then eats them because he's a goat.
He cans them, then he eats the contents, and then for good measure, he eats the can because goats like to chew.
That's right.
Garbage.
Yeah,
they'll. I mean, it's great.
And that character, I found that character not to be that useful. So really, I only did that just because I could.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I don't know. I guess if your place. Style is one that loves to utilize blue mages whenever they're available, then that's your guy. But what's the consensus? Is the blue mage always the first bench party member in every RPG you play?
Usually for me, yes.
Yeah.
I just never find those abilities. Like right. Maybe two or three of the abilities are useful.
And see, and what is it? Octopath Traveler 2. Oh my god, did I stock up on monsters to do that, because they got the blue mage people, but we'll talk about that more next year.
Yay.
And by the way, speaking of animation, every character has I forget what the game terms it, an ultimate attack that they can charge up and unleash, and those are some really nice pixel art animations, like cinematics really at that point. And I love many of those as well.
Let's talk about the characters and story, because I thought that the story was kind of intriguing.
How you wipe out the entire continent as the intro to the game.
Yeah.
Oops, set that nuke. 10,000 whatever people gone.
And you did it. Congratulations.
Yep. I clicked the button.
Your main character is a mercenary, and you're with a mercenary group called the Band of the Iron Bull that was hired to take out this thing called a grimoire. And I think that they thought that it was like a super powerful, I mean, it is a super powerful weapon, but they didn't realize what it could do.
I think they were told that it powered the weapon or defense systems of the country that they were asked to infiltrate. Like, they were hired by one country that's currently at war with another. And I think they were told that the grimoire is just something that will, like, stop the assault or open them up for a counterattack or something, you know? So kind of a battery.
Yeah, it was like, hey, you know, go shut off the shield generator down on the planet.
Shield generator on Endor. Yeah.
Yep.
And it wasn't.
Nope, it was a bomb. Huge bomb, wiped out a whole continent. That's where the prologue ends, and the game kind of tells you, like, okay, well, you wipe out the whole continent, and because of the devastation, it forced all the countries to have a peace treaty. And
yeah, so it was a little less than that. It wasn't the whole continent. It was like one whole peninsula and city. Yeah. But, like, yeah, the whole, what is it, the premise of this is this continent has, for hundreds of years or whatever, existed as three different empires at war, and you know, that you setting that off is for the first time in hundreds of years now, they've actually, like, whoa, maybe we should back up, have a nuclear peace treaty
here. You're basically you become the terrorist that unites the kingdoms. against you, against the outside threat.
Mm-hmm. Because then when those characters, the main character Glenn and his best friend Kyle, Glenn and Kyle were the ones that set off the bomb at the beginning of the game. So 5 years later, yeah.
Oh, I think here's where the pronunciation kind of rears its ugly head. I always pronounced him differently.
Kylie?
I think I went with Killian on him.
Did I pronounce?
I'm looking him up right now. Of course, there's no voice.
Killian. Yeah, it is Killian.
It is Killian. I was going to make a pun joke about killing somebody on the...
I called him, for some reason, I called him Kyle, but you're right, it is Killian. Good old dyslexia.
Poor Kyle.
And when they show up 5 years later, and it's like, how did they survive this? Mm-hmm. And Glenn has PTSD. Because of the incident, and Killian's trying to, you know, get him to snap out of it and be the good mercenary that he had been 5 years ago. Meanwhile, there's a girl named Lynn who's going around the country with her assistant Rob, and you find out that Lynn is actually the
assistant.
Yeah. Bodyguard.
I feel like he would fight you if he heard you call him that.
Bodyguard, friend, what have you. But Lynn is the Princess of Terran.
With a satin glove.
fuck him. Rob was kind of a dick.
He is a dick.
But
until he's not.
Yeah. Well, when you find out why, it's like, okay, I kind of get it. At least you're nicer now. But so she's the princess who ran away a year ago because she wanted to see the world and see what the world was up to while this peace treaty was going on. And her brother is Frederick, who is the king of Terran and the main antagonist of the game for a good chunk of the game.
But not at that time. I don't think he is he?
I don't think so.
Isn't it revealed a little bit later as you kind of go through it?
You kind of figure out that he's pulling a lot of strings to get the war to start again. And he also wasn't very happy with Lynn for running away from home because he thought that she was abandoning her duties when she was actually trying to learn more about the kingdom so that she could, you know, stop future wars. Just kind of an interesting dynamic there. And then there's Victor, who is a really famous playwright, who is just kind of a wandering bard, pretty much, and he's sort of famous for being a playwright, is also a humanoid called an heir that is long-lived. That's like their own. I thought that they were kind of elf-like, because he runs into another one.
I don't remember getting the sense of like elves. I was thinking more like the ancients from Final Fantasy VII.
Yeah, that could be too. That's just how I interpreted it.
The Seta or whatever they're called. Setra, I think, is what they're called.
Yeah. And then Sienna, who is a thief character, a red-haired thief character.
The ninja?
Yeah.
The best character?
Yeah.
In terms of combat. Maybe, I don't know, in story, but her I think it's her super move animation is great.
Yeah,
it's where the scene changes to like
a silhouette.
Like a silhouette of a traditional Japanese house, like under a moonlit night with like cherry blossoms or something. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like that real like a wall scroll kind of look, and all you see is her and the enemy behind the rice paper screen, and the way she just like, I don't know, like slices through the enemy. Her shadow slices through the enemy.
It's like right out of a Kurosawa movie.
Yeah, it's great.
So those are your main characters. Later on in the game, you get other characters. But to be honest, I used the main characters so much that the other ones were kind of worthless, maybe except for Princess Amelia, who's also part of the Princess of Ascana and part of the Rebellion and arguably the best healer in the game, but not good at much else.
I would also throw in Bothras, the lizard. He's a mercenary too, I guess. But like a real boss mercenary.
Yeah, the
he's
lizard.
Kind of like Shadow.
Yeah, he talks in first person, or I'm sorry, second person. He says he's like kind of like Venom, like we are part of this, and then you find out why, and it's like, okay, that's kind of grim.
kind of grim. His backstory is really real harrowing.
Yeah, he has
with his son.
He has mechanical arms. I just realized they did a Bionic Commando. Aren't his arms his son? Or his mechanical arms?
I couldn't tell you.
I can't remember now.
In Bionic Commando?
Well, yeah, in the modern remake of Bionic Commando, it turned out that the bionic arm was the main character's wife, and that kind of became a meme because of how absurd it was.
What the heck? Thank God I only played that back on the Super Nintendo.
Well, they did it here, Nintendo. Too. But here's his young son. His tiny son.
Yeah.
Or at least the armor digital. That he turned into. I don't know. That's, listen, don't get caught up in the physics of it all. Right? It's
not let's not get stuck in the minutiae of the
laws of the natural world. It's the fact that he's basically wearing the corpse of his son and, you know, and kind of carries that baggage around with him everywhere he goes. That's pretty terrible.
Because He made a pact with kind of a joker / jester type character that shows up when stuff goes bad and basically traded his son's soul for life or something to that effect. And of course, didn't read the fine print and it backfired horribly. Because that happens a couple more times in the game because Princess, what's her name again? Amelia apparently had the same thing happen where she survived a mass poisoning that happened to her family. And she was the only one that survived because of the pact that she made, but she only has a couple of years left to live. And then at one point, it's a story point where I think Princess Lynn makes a pact to save everyone and the Jester character shows up.
Unfortunately, I don't remember.
I felt like there should have been more to that little story thing than just that, because they never really went into that. But yeah, that's all of your main characters for the most part. And the story kind of becomes about stopping King Frederick and stopping him from using the Grimoire to wipe out the enemies of the kingdom.
Yeah, with the additional little twist that some of your characters are reincarnations of their former selves and have, and I think that's where the title comes from. Strained Echoes refers to, like, is it them regaining memories of their past lives in which they were, previously connected to each other in some way, and now they have to, I don't know, I mean, the story goes to some pretty far places.
Yeah, because the echoes are basically your character's soul. So, you know, Chained Echoes, reincarnation and all that. Victor being an heir and being long-lived has to do with that, because his he was trained by the first character in the reincarnation cycle, who was Glenn's ancestor.
So Victor's kind of your Auron, right? He kind of has been watching over from afar or from near for like millennia or whatever.
Yeah.
And Glenn and Len, what they're the two that are always like reincarnated and are they love interests with each other? I'm trying to like recall that.
They were. But back in the past, Len's ancestor was in love with a caretaker whose name I can't remember. And then she was betrothed to marry a duke. And the game kind of sets it up like Glenn and Lynn's ancestor were the lovers, but Glenn is actually the ancestor of the duke that kind of caused them both to die and felt terrible about it. I don't know. That part of the story I didn't really jive with, just because I felt like it kind of came out of nowhere. I was more invested in the political part of the story with the Grimoire and the Harbinger and basically trying to stop the calamity that was supposed to happen.
And then, of course, Killian ends up betraying the party.
The Grimoire was an ancient weapon that was built so that there's like a certain radius where you're safe so that you can set it off without dying. And it recharges by sucking in all of the echoes of the people that it killed. So that explains how Glenn and Killian survived at the beginning of the game, and also explained why this thing is so destructive and how it can still be destructive. So your party is trying to figure out a way to set this thing off and not have it kill a bunch of people so that it'll eventually die, while Frederick wants it to wipe out his enemies. And then there's another character named Gwen, who I think is also an heir because he's been alive for God knows how long. And the thing I forgot to mention is that Glenn keeps having voices in his head where he sees a door. And the door's like guiding him. I don't know if this is ringing any bells, Pascal.
It's not, no.
Okay. Not that part. I should have done spoiler warnings at the beginning, but if you've been a long-time Backtrack listener, you know we spoil the hell out of everything.
That is the point of this podcast.
It turns out that Gwen was the voice behind the door, and it was kind of guiding Gwen the whole time. And there's also some weird stuff about these gods behind the curtain that are controlling everything. I don't remember all of that specific detail because that also kind of came out of nowhere.
I'm just kind of scrolling around to look at some stuff. The Vian, I think, is what it says here.
Yeah.
The gods, you said? A group of six powerful godlike beings. So they kind of run things behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. there's a lot.
Was it like 1, 2, 3, and 4? Weren't they? I'm thinking of the wrong one.
Because there was some stuff about some gods and then some other stuff about some creatures around the world that were true kings. And you run into some of them. I played this a month ago. It's somewhat fresh in my head, but I don't remember all of the nuance.
What chance do I have? Jeez.
The guy who wrote this like really had some lore that he put into it, and yeah. Kudos to him that he was able to keep track of all this, because I sure as hell couldn't.
I mean, the church of the land plays a big part of the story too, as I recall. Like the heads of the church are always involved in this and that, and I don't remember if they end up taking sides or if they're just kind of, you know, involved in whatever capacity they want to be involved in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a lot, but. You're not going to get a lot of spoilers from me because I just don't recall most of the things.
Turns out Sienna used to be part of the church, and this was supposed to be a big revelation, and all of your characters were like, yeah, we figured that out ages ago.
Yeah, what was she, like some kind of an enforcer or something?
Yeah, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And she has history with Raphael?
Yeah.
I may be wrong on that, but he's an optional character you can recruit later. He's the current, like, one of or the best, you know, fighter in the church, right? Like, he's their current enforcer.
Like, High Inquisitor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or something kind of fancy named like that. Mm-hmm. But I think I want to say that the church is just like the Grawlschritter and the Trails series, where their job is to hunt down dangerous artifacts like the Grimoire and get them out of the hands of the people.
I mean, you certainly aren't going to be shortchanged on characters and political intrigue in this game. There's a lot of it.
I mean, this developer put a lot of thought into the story. And I could tell just by all of the different lore bits that you run into. And a lot of these lore bits you don't even really find out unless you do some of the side quests. It was just all kind of fascinating to be a part of. But yeah, main story, trying to get rid of this weapon and attacking and dethroning God. Because I think the gods, there's something in there about how the gods wanted to destroy the world. So
of course, what else would they do?
Yeah, it's a JRPG. I was going to say,
you know, at some point, yeah, when you're copying all those JRPGs of old, that's going to come up.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, we haven't mentioned Eagle yet.
Oh, yeah. The one of the last bird people in the world.
Mm. Asova Knight. Apparently, that's the name of the bird people. And he's the wet blanket of the group.
Yeah, supposedly he was the most pathetic one.
Well, among the bird people, but he's also the most straight-laced character you'll ever recruit to your party. I mean, he's all about justice and honor and these and thous and my lady and kind sir and all this other stuff.
He's basically Cyan from Final Fantasy VI, but
maybe a little less edgy.
Yeah. So, talking about spoilers, doesn't that whole town basically off themselves to keep some secret at bay? Because you go to a whole town of bird people,
mm-hmm.
and that didn't end well.
That sounds right, but yeah, I don't know. Sure. Yeah,
I think that area was called Shambhala.
Just don't quote him on that.
Yes. He's the sole survivor of the Sova village, as they all committed mass suicide in response to betraying the oath they made with the church. God, how...
As one does.
There's a lot of stuff I forgot, and stuff like this. This sounds... You know, I was thinking this earlier, when and it applies again here, when you were first mentioning about how Glenn has PTSD from killing, what, is it thousands or tens of thousands? From blowing up.
Like 10,000, yep.
Mm-hmm. This is not a lighthearted game. Like, they definitely, you know, deal with some of the trauma, but part of me really wants to wallow in it. And I kind of would love to see, we're talking to, about Lost Odyssey 2 weeks ago, and I would really love to see what would this be like if you played this game and experienced that trauma after the bomb exploding, or this mass suicide of the bird village, but through like the dark tone and the writing of something like Lost Odyssey.
I mean, if I would have played this game, would I was the same age as I was when I played Final Fantasy 6/4, I probably would have been traumatized at that bomb at the beginning because of how just incredibly dark that whole thing was. Mm-hmm. And then the game just gets kind of darker and darker with the mass suicide and some of the characters' backstories. At the same time, though, I would have really appreciated that a game was telling a mature story, because that was essentially what drew me to games like the Super Nintendo Final Fantasies, was that they were more mature and less, you know, save the princess, save the world kind of stuff. I was a teenager when I played those games, so I was looking for more, I don't want to say dark, but, you know, more mature themes in my stories.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I would have liked an even heavier focus on that part of it, like really hammer down on the mature stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I know that sounds like I'm just itching for depression, but I don't know. You don't get that in enough games, maybe. And I seem to like it when it does pop up. Here, it would have been great to see that even more heavier handed.
No, at the same time, I might be playing a Sonic Adventure or Kingdom Hearts just to cleanse my palate afterwards. I was like, man, that was dark. But yeah. I appreciate stories like that.
Well, he definitely set up a lot of lore, like you said. So if there's ever a sequel in the works, there's plenty to expand on and draw from. And
oh, it's funny you mentioned that. So in a sort of kind of future backtrack summoning, like the week after we announced we was doing this backtrack, the developer came out and said that they were putting out a DLC pack that has like a new character, a whole bunch of new side quests, a new area, and basically kind of an expansion to the game, which surprised me because the game being kind of 2 years old, but I guess he was probably, I guess it might have, if he's doing it by himself, it probably took him that long to come up with all this stuff. And what is this DLC called? We had it in our channel. Ashes of Elrant. I'm pretty sure Elrant is the place that you explode at the beginning of the game, if I'm not mistaken.
I honestly don't remember. I thought that was called Winan, but
you're right, my bad.
That's only because I read it somewhere today. I mean, it could be anything.
It could have been a town that was in the same area for all we know. It's just with a name like Ashes of Elrant, it sounds like they're dealing with that plot twist.
I want to say there's a point of the game where you go into some sort of former, like the ruins of a monastery where the monks kept records of like historical records, but I think they're all gone, right? Like the monks, like it's just the building, and your party kind of searches the ruins for any, like for the documentation or whatever, like a book or something that you're looking for. Mm-hmm. So like stuff like that, like the game even, you know, tells you about civilizations that were around and they were important, but they're no longer there. I mean, you mm-hmm. could make an expansion on so many different storyline threads that were just kind of mentioned and weren't really central to the game's plot, and now we just expand on that.
Yeah, because you also go to the ruins of an ancient magic academy that's underground too, and you kind of find the entrance to that in a side quest long before you actually go to that spot in the game, which I thought was kind of interesting foreshadowing.
That's ringing a bell a little bit with me for sure.
Yeah, because when I saw that, it's like, man, I'm dying to go to this magic academy, and it was like kind of a huge area with lots of twists and turns that you had to explore.
I'm not so sure how drawn back I would be for an extra character, though.
I am curious about it because this new character is a character named White Wolf, who is literally a white wolf.
Hmm.
Yeah, and I love my furry characters, so I want to I want to know about this guy. They haven't announced if this DLC is going to be paid or free.
Mm-hmm.
I was under the impression that it was going to be free. I could be wrong. I don't mind paying for it if it adds more to the game and gives you a little more insight into some of the lore. Because the base game itself is $25, and I picked it up on sale.
Oh yeah, I got this on a. I got it kind of early after, so I probably, you know, 20% off, not as much as you got.
I paid like 17 for it. I was basically like playing a waiting game of like, okay, the first store, digital store this goes on sale, that's where I'm buying the game and playing it. And Steam won that race.
But this is, you know, this is a $25 game with a solo developer. So does that, you know, make a difference of like who you're supporting rather than a faceless corporation?
Corporation.
Yeah.
Square Enix is going to be just fine without your $60.
I was just being cheap.
No, I don't mean like that. Just saying like, you know, so I hear from people all the time that say $25, that's way too much for a game. Like I'll wait till it goes on for much, much lower sale than that. But you know, for indie, maybe I could see myself saying, no, okay, 25 is okay. Like I'll support that.
I think you get a lot of content for your buck for full price for this game. Cause whether you get hooked or not, I mean, there's a whole bunch of stuff for you to do. There's a huge, huge world for you to explore. Lots of things that you can run around and play around with. I don't want to say lots of customization, but you can have a lot of fun with, if we forgot to mention this, the kind of gym system where you could put gems into your weapons to make them more powerful.
The crystals and how you have to combine them to make more powerful crystals. And so honestly, that's the main system that I kind of ignored. If I remember this correctly, there is an auto slot feature that kind of equips it for you with, I think it even, or it's an auto combine. Like there's a button you can just push where it figures out how to make the most powerful gem you can possibly make with what you have.
Yeah, I use that quite a bit too, just because I had a hard time wrapping my brain around it though. The way that I kind of got around its complexity was just doing a lot of the weapon specific gems, because I knew that I could give those to, because each character has their own unique weapon. So like having a spear gem go to Lynn, putting that in all of her equipment, or you know, putting a rapier gem in all of Victor's equipment, that kind of stuff. That's and even then, you only really need that system if you're doing like super bosses. So
that's definitely one area of customization that I just By the time you get to the point where you can even do it, where that system becomes available, I think it's like a good way into the game by then. Mm-hmm. And that was one system too many. That's why I say I can kind of understand the complaint of too many systems. Maybe just for that one, that one broke my camel's back.
Yeah, that one was way too complex for me too. So I agree.
And I never really in any game I don't like to. If there's an auto equip inventory button, I always use it. I really just don't like stat screens and stuff like that.
See, I don't understand, for me at least, why like a system like that with the materia system in Final Fantasy VII, I'm all about, but when that system is in like Xenoblade or this game, it's like I don't want to touch it with a 10-foot pole.
Well, the materia system is less complex, I think, than this.
Yeah.
You put in a materia and you have to pay attention to, well, and I'm talking about the OG Final Fantasy VII. I don't even remember what it's like in the new one. All you have to pay attention to is whether slots are linked or not. And then mm-hmm. the materia kind of grows on its own with experience, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's mostly for spells and stuff like that. And for the new, I mean, it works pretty much the same way for the new game. Mm-hmm. There's less materia to deal with in the newer game, which is kind of a good thing. But as far as the nuance go, once again, unless you're trying to do super bosses or the arena like me, you could pretty much do whatever you want. And if you are doing that stuff, smarter people than me have figured out the best builds. So there you go.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few other minor systems that we haven't mentioned yet in Chained Echoes that also come into play. Like each character gets a class that they can eventually
And you have to find those classes. Though, to be honest with you, the only one I found useful at all was cleric.
And then what does that do? Just gives you more skills to choose from?
It boosts your stats, and then you get a handful of skills that you can equip
that are like unique to class skills, right?
Yeah. It lets you customize your characters just a little bit more, so that if you want to give Killian a better heal spell, put the cleric. Mm. The other thing it does is you can learn those skills permanently, and I didn't figure that out until the end of the game.
You can also pair up characters with each other in battle formation, because eventually it lets you swap out your four active combat party members for their partners, but it has to be set up in advance.
Yeah.
And you can only swap out a character for their partner, not for any other character. And they have to be alive for it to happen. And it's like just one more, like it becomes such a chess game. Every encounter becomes such a chess game, I feel like.
But I love that swapping is a free action, which is a godsend. So you don't lose your turn if you swap. And it also lowers the overdrive bar.
Yeah.
We also didn't.
Can't indiscriminately. You can't swap and then re-swap right back again.
No.
It is limited to once per turn. So it can get you in hot water if you're just doing it for sake of like lowering the overdrive. Like if you do it at the wrong moment, that character may get hit the very next round, and then if he's dead, you can't swap at all anymore.
Yeah. It's like if you don't have your ultimate meter maxed out and you can't figure out a way to bring down your overdrive other than defend, you can swap out a character. And you just got to really think about, you know, who should I pair up so that if I need to swap somebody out, I'm not up shit creek.
Yeah. I kind of wanted to bring up the combat like system again anyway for its like own conversation. I know Matt already kind of ran through it, but it was my favorite my number one favorite thing about the game, just full stop, is the way you have to use strategy to keep your overdrive in the sweet spot, in the green zone. And the fact that some attacks, so like in a normal RPG, you would just spam your most expensive or your most powerful skill. And of course your party fully regenerates health and skill points after every battle, so you're really incentivized to just use whatever you want.
Mm-hmm.
I love systems that do that.
I love that too. It takes out so much stress.
Mm-hmm. But enemies are also like appropriately spongy for that, which that's one thing I don't like. And I think you can change that in the options menu, but spongy enemies is not something I usually enjoy. And I say that like I liked it here. I didn't really enjoy that here either.
Usually I love taking 10 minutes for every battle.
Yeah, I guess if you make the enemies too weak, then you don't really engage with the combat system.
Mm-hmm. You're right. It's a balance. Yeah.
Yeah. And I really, really love how the addition of some attacks at the right moment will lower the gauge instead of raise it. Mm-hmm. And Matt already said, said this exact thing, but I think Kelly, you said it too, that you're incentivized to not necessarily go with the strongest thing you have, but maybe do a weaker attack or even something that isn't maybe super appropriate for the moment. But you're kind of planning ahead. You're looking at the turn order. You see that, well, the enemy has four turns coming up, and I'm really close to the danger zone of the gauge, and I really need to lower it. So rather than doing an all-out attack, I'm going to use this, sort of useless spell that's going to just lower my gauge and kind of get me through this next onslaught, right? And how you're always kind of thinking, and the way it just becomes more and more complex when you finally get to swap characters. Now you have twice as many skills to consider from your from the pool of character abilities, and who do I want to swap in this turn, and whose skill can be used in the next turn. And it's so much going on that it's never boring. And this is kind of what I meant like earlier by it is also a lot of stress. So I'm kind of, as much as I praise it, I'm also kind of happy I got through the game and don't have to repeat the whole thing again.
I did appreciate that they give you the sky armors really early in the game, so that areas that you do end up with a lot, with some of the more annoying enemies, you can just curb stomp with your sky armor and you're fine. And we didn't talk about the sky armor combat either, because it kind of uses the same system, but instead you have different. Okay, yeah, good transition. You have different gears that you can put your sky armor in. So I think first gear, your attack and defense is normal. Second gear, your attack is higher and your defense is, I think, lower, or is it higher? I can't remember.
It's some combination. Like every gear has pros and cons, and they all move the needle in different directions. And there is no more neutral zone. There's just the sweet spot in the middle, and a danger zone on either end. So you really have to toe the line and stay in the middle. And I think there are enemies, or maybe it's just some bosses, that can mess with your overdrive gauge and make the zones like change in size. Mm-hmm. So that now you're even more on your guard, and like one wrong move or one sky armor in the wrong gear, and your whole like plan just falls apart. And you basically get wiped. It gets to that point.
Yeah, I remember the lowest gear having the highest defense, so that when an enemy is like charging up a major attack, you need to be in the lowest gear and defending, or otherwise you're gonna get screwed.
Right, but then it gets to the point of sometimes when that happens, you're kind of already like, you're looking ahead at how many more turns will each character get before this attack lands? Mm-hmm. And you figure out, I can possibly save Glenn and Len. I forget who had, who the Sky Armors are. I can save these two, but this one's screwed. I'm never going to get him into defensive gear in time. So instead, what I need to do is start planning for a revival tactic that's going to happen, three turns down the line. And while all that's happening, I also still have to maintain the overdrive gauge in the right area. And I have to find a way to stay offensive with my fourth character and dish out heals with somebody. I mean, there's always you think just because you have like a mech suit that now it's a cakewalk. But no, I think it's actually harder. The combat is more demanding, I think, in those in those encounters.
And not to mention there's areas on the map where there are big enemies that you really have to fight in your mech suit, or else if you try to take them on not in the mech suit, you're going to get creamed.
I like how Matt is like, huh, like, oh, okay, that's what I need to get to.
I sounds fun.
I remember
super stressful.
Now that I've, you know, like I said, 3-4 hours into it for the second time, I'm like, okay, like I can see where I went wrong with my planning with this last time and not engaging with this. And so, you know, keep adding these on and I think I'll become more engaged even.
Yeah.
If you thought the combat was fun for its own sake, it definitely, like, it gets new wrinkles added to it constantly. And it sounds like you're going to enjoy the game for maybe just for the sake of that. Then what I liked about it.
And by the way, I absolutely adore the mech combat in this. I could have played the whole game with just that.
There's your DLC, the mech DLC.
Yeah. Need. What else is there? I had a point I wanted to. You also can find a secret mech to unlock too.
Ooh.
Yeah, it's part of a side quest. Good thing to know.
Well, Glenn's ultimate attack is him quickly hammering together like a little mini mech that he pummels the enemies in. Killian's super attack isn't it him that has like a giant sword that stabs out of the ground, like the camera pans back to like a view of a mountain range, and this mountain-sized sword blade comes up from the ground and just like ascends into the sky, and that's basically like, here, I killed you. Yeah, I kind of reveled in that stuff. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I also remembered while I was doing research for the game, I found out that they do have a physical collector's edition that you can pre-order.
Oh, is it coming out with a physical now? Because I don't think it's been out before in physical, has it?
Yeah, no, it hasn't. Unfortunately, all of the like really fancy collector's editions for Switch are already sold out, but the regular edition for Switch is still available for $53, but it comes with the cart, a collectible coin, a fold-out map, and a full-color manual, which is something that I miss.
Manuals, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I can't help it. The first thing I do when I would get a game when I was a kid was open it up and read the manual, especially if I was riding it. What'd you say?
I said that that's what you did on the car ride home.
Yep.
Yes. Especially if it was a story heavy game, and there would be anywhere from like 1 to 4 manual pages dedicated to the story so far. And then right after the story, there would be a few pages showing you all the main characters of the game. I mean, this would be any RPG probably. That's the ride home right there. And then you'll be plenty psyched up to start the game up as soon as you step into the house.
And it was a thing when I was a kid where we would bring game manuals to school and kind of trade them back and forth so that other kids could read them and, you know, experience the game vicariously, which I thought was kind of funny. That's something that kids today just don't understand. Some of the fancier collector's editions that are sold out have a Super Nintendo like box for the game too. Unfortunately, if I wanted that, I'd have to buy the PlayStation 4 retro edition, and it's $75.
Going through those, yeah.
The Super Collector's Edition that I think is sold out on all editions comes with a music box, CD, silver necklace with gemstone pendant. Wow.
Did you say music box?
Yeah, wooden music box.
Whoa. I'm not so sure I understand what the connection to the game is there, but that's interesting.
I don't know either. And a large hardcover art book, but this edition is also $318.
Whoa, wow.
But I think it's sold out for all of them. Yeah. So So there you go. If you want a physical copy, you can go to firstpressgames.com. I think I'm fine. I like this game. I don't like it enough to want to pay $50 for the physical edition, even though I am a physical forever person.
I gave up my physical forever card. About two, actually, almost exactly 3 years ago. That was my 2022 resolution. Like, bye bye. Can I clean up the one tub of games I have and make it none?
It's sad, sad, sad.
I know. I, y'all aren't the audience for this.
No, I appreciate your devotion to minimalism because I wish I could be like that sometimes. I've got too much crap. But
what's the whole, gosh, what was the Bruce Willis movie, Unbreakable or whatever? I have to be the opposite.
Okay.
Yep. For all the hoarders out there, for all the physical forever, I feel like I need to be the polar opposite.
So you're saying I'm the Mr. Glass in this equation and you're the...
Well, I mean, I might be the Mr. Glass in this situation. I'm the one causing chaos with the physical community. Like, no, buy us. And, oh, I refuse to buy you.
As she looks over her four copies of Stray.
I don't even have a Stray copy of Stray. On any digital device.
Well, did we have anything else we wanted to talk about with the game? It had a good soundtrack, but I don't remember anything from it.
Oh, God. How did we not mention that? The music is great.
I
know you mentioned the composer.
I mean, I did.
Sounds like somebody wants that music box.
I don't want a music box for it.
So I played the whole game on my Steam Deck. I did make a point to try not to play it with the volume down when I could get away with it. It's just one of those things that the music was beautiful. No tracks stood out to me in particular.
There is one, but I'll save it for the round table.
Okie dokie. Does that mean that we're all ready for the round table?
Sounds like it.
Our final verdict on the game. It's good.
It's great.
Well, Pascal. Yeah, I was going to say, going by our grading system, 4.5 out of 5, Pascal gave it a great.
Yeah. Well, listen, I mean, it's, you know, sometimes, and especially 2 years after, mm-hmm. review scores don't necessarily resonate the same in your head 2 years later, but.
True.
Yeah. Despite the fact that this is not one that I could see myself replaying for, you know, reasons I've stated already, but I think it's fair to say this is great. Like it has so many, not even well done. It has so many, everything is beyond well done. Everything is thought out meticulously executed like to, you know, probably near perfection. If the worst thing that I can find is you put one system too many, then that's not a knock.
Better than having one too few and just boring.
And that one system is, you know, other people will love it. Like there are plenty of people who love customizing their weapon gem equipment or whatever. I think the game is great. And I could even see it being worth the $50 physical price if I didn't already have it. This is the kind of game that I definitely am glad I played. And if I hadn't played it, it would be worth buying a physical copy to play. Not the I wouldn't do the $300 fan box, but
within reason,
I wouldn't do that.
Run out and buy the physical one.
I mean, I am glad that I stuck with it because I very nearly bailed towards the beginning because the game is kind of a slow burn. I will admit, I feel like it really doesn't, you know, I don't want to say it doesn't get good, but by the second chapter, because that's not true. It starts out good. It's just the second chapter is where it really takes off and becomes amazing. Once you're given the freedom to fly around everywhere and do a lot of exploring and find some of the side quests and stuff, I think that that's when the game really shines.
Yeah, but the story isn't a slow burn, I don't think. We were already talking about how even the intro ends with a nuke bang, exploding, man. And then it immediately transitions to 1 year later and you play Len and Rob in a city, and something about that, like in a peaceful city, and something about that transition between two characters caught in a bomb explosion cut to two completely separate characters in this beautiful, vibrant, colorful city, you know, doing, I don't know, mundane, everyday things. Like, even that's intriguing. So it doesn't give you all the ability to do everything at the beginning. You don't get mechs to fly around in, but I don't think the story is necessarily a slow burn. I mean, not slower than like the games that from that era, from the 16-bit era. Like if you went back, or if you gave a kid the controller and say, play this, I think they would say something similar, like, oh, where is Fortnite?
And to be fair, the reason that first chapter is basically setting up all the pieces. Because I also forgot to mention in a homage to Final Fantasy VI again, there's a bit where your three characters split up. They don't stay split up for nearly as long as they are in Final Fantasy VI, but I was like, yeah, I can see what you did there, Dev. That's pretty genius. Mm.
I would even argue I like the story beats in Chapter 2 more than later. Because once it gets too heavily invested in the, I don't know what to call it, not parallel timelines, but the whole, millennia ago versus now, and like the way that the realities keep repeating themselves, and the whole God wants to destroy the world, so you have to kill God, kind of. Once it gets invested in that, then it's like, well, I've seen these story beats before, and I like it better when it's slightly more intimate and you get those character moments from, I guess that's what you're talking about, Chapter 1, where it has to set up the different characters and their backstories and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I would argue that I would prefer that.
Yeah. No, I can see that.
But yeah, no, it's all good in the end.
Put it this way. I think that this game, as a genuine homage to the RPGs of the 90s, captures a lot more of the spirit than some of the Squeenix ones tried to. Like, I'm looking at you, I am Setsuna. I'm pointing at you specifically. Because all that game was trying to do was invoke Chrono Trigger, and Chrono Trigger it was not. That was the most boring game I've ever played in my entire life.
Are we ever going to have a show on Setsuna?
I don't know. The way I sell it, nobody else wants to play it, so it's just me ranting about sad piano music and snow for 20 mm-hmm. minutes.
Yeah.
And how it was a cure for my insomnia, but I digress. Well, it sounds like a good opportunity to transition to the round table now. Welcome back to RPG Backtrack, where we are now getting into our Chained Echoes roundtable, our personal feelings, our thoughts, our memories. My question I always ask first, what is your favorite / funniest moment from the game?
I'm going to defer to Pascal, because he just showed me what will become my favorite moment of the game.
But this is going to take away the... never mind. All right, I can get a separate answer for another one. The funniest moment is music-related, which is in whatever town this happens in, and I do think it is early in the game. I think it's in the marketplace, maybe with Len and Rob, when you first run around their main town after the big explosion. Mm-hmm. You stumble across a turtle racetrack, and you can bet on turtles to see if they win. The race takes about 20 seconds or so. And as the turtles like inch toward the finish line, the serene town music fades away, and this fast-paced thrash metal, heavy metal track like accompanies these turtles on their slow-paced journey. And it in a game that's not really, I think, stuffed full of comedy, it's like, that's great. Whoever thought of putting that in there, and you can experience it as often as you want. And it's just this sting of just like silliness that needs no context. And I love it.
Yeah, I sent my husband that clip that you sent, and he thought that was pretty funny. And I'm pretty sure there was a similar joke in Undertale with the snails. Only the kind of, it wasn't really heavy metal music. It was kind of like a heavy metal MIDI that played with the snail race. But same joke, fast-paced song, slow-ass animals.
Yeah.
But I like the turtle one better because it's more metal.
And it ends on this like guttural scream from the singer. And then the song kind of peters out like moments before the turtles like are actually in place at the finish line. And then there's just this, and this is probably unintentional, but it kind of like hammers it home. There's just this like awkward silence for about 5 seconds afterward while the game like transitions back into giving you control and like fading in the other music and stuff. There's just this nothingness while the turtles just stand there and then the game continues on as normal.
Like, it's like, no, that's a brilliant joke.
Yeah.
I love it. And yeah, there isn't a lot of levity in this game because I wrote down my favorite moment is in the beginning. Sienna is getting ready to ditch the party. She's like, well, screw you guys, I'm not sticking around. And then sees the gang that was chasing her, trying to find her, and is like, I guess I'll go with you guys after all. Yeah, it's like, yay,
to an end.
My best damage dealer is back. So did any of you guys have a favorite character?
I need more time with it.
I closed my list of characters, but I'm going to say, I don't know. I guess I really am kind of partial to Bothraz. I believe that what it said his name was. Now I'm going off of my 2-year memory here. Not just because of his backstory. I think he's also very useful in battle, and I like his design. He's the muscular lizard guy. Oddly enough, if I didn't pick him, I might pick Victor. So that skit that we did earlier might kind of applies a little bit. he's one of the more useful bards I've had in a game, I'll say that.
He's certainly no Edward. Nor is he Spoony.
He's not. I think he ended up being a good healer for me, though. I think I only occasionally switch to, who's the other healer? Is that Amelia or whatever her name was?
Yeah, Amelia basically has nothing but healing spells. And
go ahead.
No, Lynn only had healing spells because I gave her the cleric.
I want to say I kept Amelia for like dire emergencies, like near party wipes kind of situation. Mm-hmm. And I think the rest of the time I went with Victor because I had him to where he could heal, but I believe he also could do some damage output. So he was more useful like in the general flow of battle. It was either damage or buffs that he was doing for me. I can't quite recall.
Victor was really good at doing buffs.
Maybe that's what it was.
He had a regen that he could do. He had a TP regen that he could do. Yeah. And he could also buff your attack and defense. And then you do all this and then a mob would just wipe it out.
And I'm pretty sure I had them paired up to different characters so that I could potentially bring both healers into combat simultaneously instead of switching between them like when that was needed. I mean, I played on the default setting, so you know the battles were kind of lengthy. And I don't think I said this earlier. I don't know if any of us said, but like I would count this game as hard. Like this is not an easy game if you play it on factory settings.
Yeah, I bumped down the difficulty just so that I wouldn't beat my head so much against it.
Yeah, it's a lot.
Mm-hmm. There were a couple of puzzle bosses that I had issues with, but other than that, I had a pretty easy time. That being said, my favorite character is Victor. Not only do I prefer kind of the older men characters, and well, you can't get much older than him. I just thought that he was a really kind of good-hearted, light-spirited kind of guy to the point where I was honestly surprised that he never betrayed the party. Because it's like, this guy is so nice. There's got to be something going on with him. And it's like, nope, he's just a cool playwright. Really nice. Had a cute laugh. The she thing. I thought he was adorable. But Sienna was my best fighter. Hands down.
Yeah, I was just thinking about her too. Should have made a spot for her as well. It's too many characters to choose from then.
So I did figure out that Baltharaz could get a pretty wicked combo going because he'd summon weapons and basically build them up, and then you could do one move to unleash them, and it would do just massive amounts of damage.
I kind of wish that Glenn had been less useful in battle, because I really did not much enjoy him, like as far as like his presence, you know.
Yeah. And,
but I always felt pressured to have him in the combat party because he was very powerful. He had that, like, what is it, triple or like quadruple swing or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It was hard to not have him be part of battle, but I honestly would have preferred some characters with other personalities. He was not my favorite, I would say.
I ended up sort of liking Kyrian more because Kyrian had an AoE attack, and I think I had to give Glenn a specific class emblem to have him have an AoE. So yeah.
How about the guest party member you get at the beginning, the leader of the Iron Bull? Clan, the one who's like a minotaur, and he wields I don't remember exactly what he has as a weapon. It's something unusual,
you know. I could have sworn that he was gonna come back because he, when you do the weapon stuff, he stays in the AI or in the UI the whole time,
so he's still around. I don't remember him coming back at all.
No, he never came back, but I could have, I thought, well, surely he's going to come back at some point. Otherwise, he wouldn't be in the UI and I couldn't, you know, mess with his loadout here, but...
So he's dead is what we're saying, right?
Yeah. I'm pretty sure he's dead. Unless they address that in the DLC.
Well, how would he have survived? He shouldn't have.
Duck and covered? I don't know.
Because he was at the, you know, ground zero of the blast.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so he would have been cool to have around. He would have fit right in with the group.
I agree. That's why I was disappointed that he never did come back. It's weird to have a character still be in the UI if they're dead in a game. I honestly think that was an oversight.
I mean, I'll spend every day of my life probably, you know, wishing that General Leo had come back in Final Fantasy VI, but that was not to be either.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what it'd be like. It'd be like seeing General Leo in your equip menu the whole game. And
here, you remember this guy? Well, you can't have him back.
Yeah. Though if it was kind of an unaddressed plot point, that brings up my next question. Are you going to check out the DLC?
We don't know exactly when it's coming, right?
Just sometime in 2025 is all our press release said.
So probably not Q1.
Probably not Q anything for me. I just don't see. I mean, I already said the one additional character doesn't draw me. The character wouldn't be a draw for me, and I'm guessing it would be accessible through the main game, so it would require replaying the game up to a certain point. And 2 years after the fact seems a little long.
If it was in the middle while I was playing it, why not? But yeah, I'm with Pascal. I don't go back to games just because they add a little something.
I want to know more about the DLC before I kind of say anything. Just because I'm with you, I very rarely go back to games. But if they give me a compelling enough reason to want to go back, then I could.
I'm going to say it sounds like a great addition for the people that are buying the physical copy now. Because then they'll have it, you know, when they play the game for the first time or replay it or whatever. Yeah, but I just don't think that I'm in the mood to replay it. It's too soon to replay it, and it's too long since I've played it to really remember much about it.
Mm-hmm.
I
was gonna say, you're right. It's at that time. Like, I don't want to really do a full replay yet, and yet I don't. It's been a couple years. You don't want to just dump back it or dip back in just for this one piece of extra content.
I would be hopeful though that it's maybe a sign of a sequel. I mean, I would definitely would like to check out a sequel. It was I had enough fun with it that I would be curious what else would come.
I'm curious too, mainly because I'm curious if a sequel would, you know, do the classic RPG thing and not have anything to do with the main game, or, you know, just deal with a different content with a different continent with a different set of characters, because the world map did show other continents.
Yeah.
So I don't know. You'll probably hear me talk more about the DLC on RPG Cast as we get more information. So do you guys have any associative memories what you were doing when you played this game? I played it in November, so I just remember beating it over my November kind of break, the Thanksgiving break.
Yeah, it came out in like December of 22. Is that what we said? Or 23?
Mm-hmm.
22. And even though I was playing it right around that time, it did take a little while to get through it. I mean, this isn't much of a memory, but I remember on the site we were doing the end of year awards, and kind of a shame that I think this one would have, for me and probably a few others, this one would have made it into some sort of like awards listing, but it came out so close to the end of the year that I don't know if it did. I don't know if like the timing allowed me to finish it in time for awards. Now I would want to go back and see if we did, if it made it into the awards that year or not. But I think that, you know, just across the board, like every content creator that does any kind of like best of the year, that game had a lot of buzz, but the release might have meant that it didn't get enough exposure after the fact. Mm-hmm. And then would have been a full year later for anybody. So I don't know. I mean, I just tried to, you know, play it more or less as quickly as I could. I didn't race through it, but I did play it for review. So I know I kind of wanted to, you know, see it through in a good time. So I didn't have a chance to build up a lot of associated memories with it.
Oh, that's fair.
And I think I mentioned earlier, I played it like June 2023 and then had to set it aside because I wasn't bringing my Switch with me, and just recently picked it back up. But knowing I wasn't going to finish in time for this episode, I did about 3 hours, 4 hours, not a whole ton. But this is like, I'm like looking, I'm like, this and Sea of Stars is what I'm going to play for the next month or two. Finish both of these off. I'm interested.
Yeah, because I'm pretty sure our next show after the beginning or after the end of the year is going to be Sea of Stars. We've got a couple of people kind of iffy if they're going to play it or not. But I mean, we managed to get through okay with three people on this show. I'm sure that we can round up a bunch of content for Sea of Stars if it's just three of us, especially if you plan on playing it, Matt.
Mm-hmm. And it shared so much of the same spotlight as Chained Echoes.
Yeah, like a year later, it was definitely
not even a year.
Well, 10 months, because didn't it come out like September, October the next year?
Something like that, yeah.
I'm shocked. I thought it was less.
They got compared quite a bit.
Yeah, two, you know, really pretty throwback indie RPGs, and they did get, I think, quite, you know, like I said, quite a bit of buzz, and I honestly thought they were far closer together. I'm surprised it's that far.
I did too, but, you know, time and all that fun stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we did our job. Sounds like we convinced Matt to keep going with Chained
Echoes. Oh, definitely. So. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm happy that you're giving it a second chance, Matt, because I was with you for a little while with that until I realized that I could change the length of the overdrive bar. And once I changed that, it was like, okay, I can deal with this now. And I'm glad I stuck with it because I was pretty amazed by how hooked I got to this game.
Yeah, I mean, already just the past week, I've enjoyed it, I think, more than I did back then.
Even though we spoiled the hell out of it for you, but...
Oh, it's okay. I'm like a goldfish. I have already forgotten.
Well, I figure our scattershot memories would not let you have any context.
You never have to worry about me spoiling, because I would have to remember it myself.
It's like I didn't want to do a drunken plot by plot breakdown like I did with Chrono Trigger. So it's like this happens, and then I think this happens, and oh, I forgot about this. So luckily that was vague enough for you.
Oh, you're good. You're good.
Well, listener, I believe that is the end of Backtrack for 2024. We had a good year this year.
It's all good. And there were better times.
Yeah. Yeah, we've got the sheet started for 2025. We've got some stuff filled out. We're going to be doing Atelier April and Monster Mash May.
And MMO June.
Yeah, Matt Mason out. Since it's going to be dealing with a lot of games that are eligible in 2023, we're going to have some very interesting shows. Final Fantasy 16, so we can finally, well, at least non-Q&A quest listeners can hear David have a shit fit about that game, and me try me either seeing his side or, you know, crying in the corner, like, what was I thinking?
Hold on, I gotta take notes so I know what my homework for this year is.
Final Fantasy 16?
That, I can do that. That's on my list already.
We're probably going to have Baldur's Gate 3 because I know a ton of us on staff played that. And
I am so scared to start playing that.
Let's see what else. We could potentially have Tears of the Kingdom or Octopath Traveler 2. I'd love to talk Tears of the Kingdom, but I don't know if anybody else on staff played it.
I haven't. Goddamn. Are you gonna have any 10-hour RPGs on this year, or is it just 100-hour monsters?
Crap, because
this is gonna be rough.
Fuga 2, but that was a lot of hours. And I deactivated my Twitter, so I can't just go there and see my completed games list right this second. I'd have to find my archive, but 2023 was a huge freaking year for games. Like, oh my god, I can't believe how many games came out that year that were like 4.5 or 5 out of 5s on our site. So it's going to be an interesting planning session. So thank you, listener, for hanging out with us all this year, and thank you, Bat, for editing and helping out and being my podcast partner in crime. Could not do this without you. And thank you, Pascal, for hanging out with us tonight.
Sure, we went the whole show, and not a single comment was made about being off the chain.
I almost wrote a skit about it, but then Matt came in with some better jokes than I could do. So, and
copyright Google Gemini.
Another thank you to our regular show people that we have on: Josh, Sam, Tam / Robert, David, Wheels,
any of the Ryans,
any of the Ryans. there are three of them. Pick one. Or all of them. And of course, thank you, listener. We shall see you in 2025 with the newest of games. Hope you look forward to it. Your best.